controversy. Now, once again, though, let me point out that these priorities, you know, community versus outside of your community, Israel versus outside of Israel, they apply when the needs are of equal urgency. But a person still has to make an assessment what is more urgent than another, and one must act accordingly. Now, one of the big issues we have, though, is, okay, what's the definition of poor? We're talking about giving to poor people. Let me give you a very common scenario. It's no secret, of course, that in our community and many other communities, we are bombarded, one could use the word, with people from Israel who are collecting for a wide variety of situations. I'm not referring to the institutions where people are collecting for yeshivot or the like, but often they are collecting for themselves. And the typical scenario is that they have, bli ayin hara, a large family, and they are collecting so not only will they be able to make a wedding, but they'll be able to buy an apartment. Now, buying an apartment in Israel can be very expensive. If you want to buy an apartment in the very religious parts of Yerushalayim, it can be anywhere from $200,000 to $500,000. The real estate has gone up tremendously. So somebody is saying, I need $300,000 to buy my children an apartment in Israel. Now, your response might be, you know, I wish I had $300,000 to buy an apartment in Israel. Am I obligated, if somebody needs money to make a wedding, of course you give it to them. If somebody needs money for food, you give it to them. If somebody needs money to pay rent, you give it to them. But is there any mitzvah at all to give money so that somebody should be able to buy an apartment in Israel, particularly where they'll have 10 other kids after that? That is a very, very difficult question. There are rabbanim that take the position that the mitzvah of giving charity for what is called hachnasas kala, to allow a bride to get married, does refer to basic necessities, which include the making of a basic wedding, whatever that means, food, clothing, and the ability to have a place to live, but it does not encompass giving them the resources to be able to buy a house, particularly if it's something you don't even have in Israel. However, there are others that have said that it's a more complicated situation in Israel. For good or for bad, and it's a pretty lousy system in many ways, it is often a condition for a marriage to be able to go through that there be a piece of property that is owned by the couple. In other words, the concept basically is, my daughter will not be able to get married unless this is provided, meaning this is a shidduch breaker. This is a marriage breaker. Now, you might argue, well, that's just blackmail. So somebody says, I'm not marrying unless you get me a house. Therefore, does that become stucca? But some rabbanim say, in view of the fact that the marriage will often not be able to be concluded unless this is supplied, this is considered to be a basic need. On the other hand, one has to approach it with common sense, because there are areas outside of the major metropolitan areas like Yerushalayim in which apartments can be purchased for much less. And nobody should have a right to say, I demand that you subsidize my ability to buy an apartment in the middle of Yerushalayim, which is the most expensive. In point of fact, there have been many Hasidic leaders, the Ger Rebbe and the like, who have actually prohibited young married couples from buying in Yerushalayim or Bnei Brak for the first 5 years of their marriage. He requires them to buy in outlying areas because they're cheaper. So it's a complicated issue which requires in some way that you kind of evaluate the facts and determine what is necessary. Another issue that we face with the Israeli Meshulach is there anything such as a duty to work? In other words, somebody doesn't have money because they don't work. And in many cases, they don't even regard that as a problem. They don't even understand the question exactly. What do you mean? You know, well, first of all, it is a lot of work to collect money. One should recognize that that itself takes a lot of work and humiliation as well. In many ways, it depends. There is indeed a doctrine in halacha that the ani who refuses to work does not have to be supported by the community because he has the option of working. But one must consider the totality of the circumstances. Halacha does recognize although we may have some problems with it, the legitimacy of devoting your life to the study of Torah. It is not necessarily the right thing for everybody, but it is a certain midah. And if the person is indeed seeking support for someone who is sincerely and conscientiously devoting themselves to Torah study, it's a big mitzvah to support them. That's not true for everybody. Some people just have a way of life in which they don't work for various reasons. But you know, if indeed there is that sincere commitment, there is a mitzvah. Sometimes there are health problems which need to be considered. And sometimes there are issues about the Israeli economy that need to be considered. I mean, there are people who simply don't work. And that's unfortunate. That actually is breeding an intergenerational poverty. It's a very, very scary thing that there's a whole segment, a large segment of the Haredi community, which really has no economic prospects at all because the rich fathers-in-law are running out. I mean, you know, when it started, you had the in-laws that were supporting, but now it's inter-multi-generational where nobody has any money and all they're doing is collecting money. That's, frankly, a rotten system that needs to be corrected. And there are some steps towards correcting it. But there are others who are sincerely devoting themselves to learning. There are those that have severe health problems. Even then, though, you have to check, well, doesn't Kupat Cholim cover some of this, right? People want to go to America. Is equivalent service available in Israel? These are questions. And then there are those that literally are trying to get employment and cannot. I had a case the other week, and this was really the first I ever had a case like this. The person was raising money. What happened? He had a 16-year-old who the police rounded up in the middle of the night and put in jail. Why? Because the person made a statement. He was interviewed on television about the Gaza withdrawals, and he just made a statement that, you know, I think the Arabs should be expelled from Israel. Apparently, Israel has some very strict anti-sedition laws. The police round up, threw him in jail, and he was trying to raise money for a legal defense fund, right? So there are all sorts of unusual causes that one needs to consider. So the point is, there is a problem of who is poor. I mean, if I want to collect money because I cannot afford something very expensive, that doesn't necessarily make me poor. But one has to look at the totality of the dynamics of the situation, particularly as it applies to weddings. I will say that there is an increasing recognition in the ultra-Orthodox community in Israel that its economic viability needs to be established in some way or the other. And this creates a whole horde of problems because the Haredi does not believe in going to college for whatever reason, the bad influences, etc. But there is a movement towards starting vocational and trade schools to give people the ability to be self-sufficient, which is the highest form of tzedakah. And by the way, if you get a request from those organizations, I would say it's a very important tzedakah to give to because this will ultimately enable self-sufficiency. And the Rambam says, giving somebody the tools to become self-sufficient is the highest form of tzedakah, and those organizations are actually in the business of doing that. That's going to create a whole host of problems because once people are making a living, they have to have military service then. So, you know, all of these issues are interrelated. But as I say, one has to have the patience and the kindness to evaluate each situation separately. Just a few more points. The Chafetz Chaim has an interesting ruling. The Chafetz Chaim says, if I borrow money from a bank to give to a poor person, and as a result, I incur interest charges to the bank, I can treat that interest charge as a tzedakah donation, which is a credit against maaser. And not only that, but if I withdraw money from my own bank account and I forego interest I would otherwise make, the interest that I'm losing is treated as a charitable contribution in and of itself. Right? So that's kind of hidden maaser deductions. The interest that you're losing by giving money to the poor can be treated as a maaser deduction, which is a credit against your charitable obligations. Just the final thing that I'll open myself up for questions. And that is, and I know that Stucca works on this, Ira works on this a lot, and that is the issue of commissions and hidden costs. People who collect for institutions obviously get paid for their services. Sometimes they get paid a straight salary. And that actually is recommended by professional fundraisers. Other times they get a commission, which means, of course, part of the money that you're paying is going to pay the fundraiser. It's going to general administrative costs. It is not necessarily going towards the ultimate aims of the institution. And the question is does halacha permit that to be done? The short answer is yes, because after all, fundraisers have to make a living as well. There's nothing wrong, per se, with a mishulach taking a cut. The question is, what type of cut is halachically permissible? So there is an oral tradition in the name of Aaron Cutler, although this is not in writing, that says a mishulach is halachically allowed to take up to 49.9%, meaning to say as long as 50% plus $1, most of each dollar goes to the charity, you can have an overhead factor of as much as 49%, and that would be halachically proper. Well, halacha may allow it, but obviously, an important factor in your decision where to allocate your funds will be what percentage of the funds go to the intended beneficiaries. The minimum halachic requirement is 50% plus 1 cent. That's the minimum. But obviously, people will tend to prefer those charities in which more of your dollar goes to the beneficiaries and less to administration. Once again, that's one of the valuable services that the tzedakah.com provides. Now, obviously, if you have a charity where more than 50% goes to cost, that is treated as an invalid endeavor, and one should not contribute to that type of institution. And hopefully, the pressure of not contributing would cause that institution to reform its internal practices. I just want to end with a final story. You know, one of the advantages of the Maser institution is that it's very hard for people to part. A lot of people don't like to give. In fact, it's recorded in our Svarim that in the olden times we used to have the Yetzirah for idol worship, right? We used to always worship idols. That was taken away, but now the Yetzirah is to hold on to our money. Money becomes our new idol. And to give up a dollar is painful for people. Now, one of the good things about Maser is if you know ahead of time that 10% of your money is not yours, or 20% is not yours, it's going to go to charity no matter what, then as you're doling it out to different charities, you don't really feel you're giving up something because this is money that already belongs to charity anyway. That's why people are actually encouraged to have separate accounts, bank accounts, called Maser accounts, where this money goes in right away and they pay their charity from these accounts. And in that way, they don't have the Yetzer Hara of thinking, gee, I'm giving up too much of my money. They tell a story, actually Rabbi Shlomo Riskin tells the story, but it's a very cute Maisa. There was a great man, the Altar of Nevardek, the old man of Nevardek, who was a great, great Baal Musar, somewhat of an extremist. And he was collecting money for his many yeshivos, and there was a fellow in town who was known as the town miser. And everyone said to him, don't bother, you won't get anything from this guy. And the Altar of Nevardek comes in and he gets a huge donation. So another Rosh Yeshiva, who had tried unsuccessfully to get money, goes over to the Altar of Nevardek and says, what's your secret? I've been trying for years to get something from this guy. He never gives me anything. How do you go in and get everything? So the Altar of Nevardek says, I'll tell you my secret. You walk in, you see a fancy house, you see beautiful rugs, you see beautiful furniture, you wipe your feet very carefully, you walk in, tiptoe, not to disturb any of the glass, any of the china. You give the guy the impression that his wealth is magnificent, his wealth is wonderful. Well, if you then ask a person to give up something that is so wonderful and so precious, he won't want to do it. People don't want to give up that which is precious to them. They don't want to give. I walk in, the Altar of Nevardek says, I don't wipe my feet, you know, I track mud through the carpet. I sit down, I have no respect for his possessions. I make him realize I'm doing him the favor, that it's not that he's giving me something, but I'm giving him the opportunity to do a mitzvah. Ah, then he'll give because everybody wants to take. Meaning, my message is, by giving, you're taking. Your message is, you're giving something up. And the truth of the matter is, Rabbi Riskin concludes, this is actually a famous thought, that's why when the Jews were called upon to donate to the Beis HaMikdash, the Pasuk uses the phrase, take unto me a donation. Because from the Jewish perspective, when you give to others, you're actually taking. You're getting more than you're giving. You're getting olam haba. You're learning compassion. You're learning kindness. You're opening your hearts. You're getting the mercy of God, because the mercy we show to others is the mercy that Hashem will show to us. And therefore, one should always regard the charity that they give as the ultimate benefit that they're getting. As the saying goes, you only take from this world what you have given. Meaning to say, the stuff that you keep when you leave this world does not go with you. The stuff that you've given is what goes with you. But it takes a great deal of wisdom, because once again, if you throw around your money indiscriminately, that's also not the right way. Because you give your money to the first cause that comes along, then it's not going to be available for the next cause that might be more important. It takes forethought. It takes planning. In fact, I would suggest, other than the token donation, when you have a lot of requests, one should save them up for at least a month at a time, maybe even longer, and have a whole bunch of things in front of you in which you can sort out and prioritize. Because what happens is, if we start responding in order to the demands that come in, we're not going to have money for the more vital stuff. So you need to have a bird's eye view of what is coming in. What they tell a story about a fellow who was a very generous Baal Stucca, and he gave a very generous donation to somebody, but the someone wasn't happy. And he started yelling at him, and he said, "You're cruel, you're heartless. Why don't you give me more?" So the man responded very calmly, "You're right, I'm very cruel. And you're very lucky I'm very cruel, because if I would have been kinder, I would have given all my money to the guy who came before you. And it is only my meanness that allows me to have some money to give you. So be happy that I'm not as generous as you would like me to be." And that's really the conflict, because we're supposed to be generous, we're supposed to open our hands. But we also have to take into account the whole picture and be sure that we have the resources to do what needs to go later. The Vilna Gaon says, I'll just end here, a beautiful vort. When the Torah says, don't be cruel, the Torah describes it, don't close your hand, open your hand. Right? That's what charity is described as, opening your hand. The Vilna Gaon makes the following observation. When you close your hand, all your fingers look equal height. When you open your hand, you see that each finger is different. Charitable giving does require the ability to make discriminations. You have to see there's a longer finger and a shorter finger. And that is why charity is described as opening your hand to prioritize and figure out the right way to go. So the pasuk says, Lo yechdal evyon mikeref haaretz. There will always be poor people in the world. They are God's emissaries to teach us compassion and goodness. And may we be zocha to respond to these mitzvos with joy and with enthusiasm, and at the same time with the intelligence to be able to make the appropriate differences. So thank you. I'll be glad to take your questions.
We invited people to submit questions by email. So while these index cards are being submitted, I'll give to Rabbi Breidowitz two questions we got by email. I think you've seen them.
Okay. Yes, I've heard it said that you shouldn't give to homeless people on the streets because they may not be using the money for proper purposes. The handouts make people dependent, and that the money should be saved and given to an organized charity. On the other hand, is it for us to judge the person on the street? If someone is asking us for help, shouldn't we respond? Very, very excellent question. Let me just backtrack for a moment and discuss the general issue of non-Jewish charities. I would assume that most homeless are non-Jews. There is a mitzvah to give charity to general, not religious, not, you know, Catholic Church or anything, but to general non-Jewish or societal causes. The Mishnah does say explicitly that this creates darchei shalom, this creates peace and amicable human relations. There are many opinions that even say you can deduct it from your maser money if you give to a non-Jewish charity. Now, the issue of the homeless becomes, are you hurting or are you helping? Certainly, a large proportion of the money might be used for alcohol or drugs, and in which case, it would be better for them not to have it. On the other hand, some of it is used for basic food and necessities. It's a hard question. I think a token donation is appropriate because that is a sign of respect. Part of giving money is not just the money, but it's to show that you are a human being. I will not just ignore you. Now, one of the things that I've tried, with only moderate success, is to give a food voucher instead of cash. For example, you give them a coupon, they can go to Snyder's or Giant's or Shalom's, whatever you have. I found in many cases they don't accept it, which belies a little bit the claim that they want food. But you know, I think if you can do that, that might be a way of ensuring that the money would be used for a better purpose. So I would only give a token donation unless it's something like a food voucher, in which I would give them more, because that could be used for a basic need. I think the idea that they're using it for bad reasons and destructive reasons is a serious enough concern that I would not be overly generous. On the other hand, I would support homeless shelters. I think it's a beautiful chinuch of children as well that they should participate in bringing food to homeless shelters and visiting people and the like, because there you do know that the money is being used to help people who are homeless. But it is a difficult question. I have more questions here. Are donated goods considered tzedakah? Yeah, I think I did answer that. You can, in fact, donate the value of the goods minus the 10% that would go to tzedakah if you would sell the good and get money for it. But only goods that are donated to places that will give them to needy people or use needy people, or even to places like libraries. Yeah, again, libraries are considered to be charitable organizations simply because they provide people without funds, among others, access to education. So a library is considered to be a worthy cause. Okay, just reading the questions here. Does the obligation to give every person extend to non-Jews? Yes, it does. That is called Darchei Shalom. In order to create peace in the world, we do give charity to non-Jews as well. Can I give tzedakah to a hungry person by physically going with him to a non-kosher restaurant? Does it matter if the hungry poor person is Jewish? That's a very, very interesting question. If the poor person is not Jewish, and you can assume that they're not if you don't know to the contrary, because most people in America are not Jewish, you can indeed take him to a non-kosher restaurant, although generally it's not proper to go to a non-kosher restaurant because of maris ayin. This maris ayin means appearances of impropriety. Actually, it's interesting. This just reminds you of a funny story. There's a book that Feldheim published a few years ago, When Black Becomes a Rainbow. Very interesting book. It's about a mother whose daughter became very, very religious, and the mother and father were not religious. And it talked about the conflicts of the mother and the daughter as they navigated this different lifestyle. So every time the mother wanted to take the daughter somewhere, the daughter was always saying, I can't go because of Maris Ayin. So the mother finally gets frustrated. Who is this Maris Ayin that you're always talking about? You know, is this guy everywhere? No. But, you know, we say Maritz Ayin, as we say in Israel, the appearance of the eye. But in a case like this, as long as you're not eating anything, you're sitting at the table, maybe you're having a drink or a soda, and that person is eating a meal, I think that's appropriate. Now, if he's Jewish, indeed there's a serious halachic problem, because you are essentially, even if the person doesn't keep kosher, but you're paying so the person will eat non-kosher food, that actually is not proper. Now, in a community like Silver Spring, you do have some kosher restaurants. We don't have the largest variety. So you should really try to take him to either kosher restaurants or give him a voucher where he decides what he buys. But to bring him into a non-kosher restaurant would be a violation of not putting a stumbling block in front of the blind. Can I add the postage I pay to send a check to a charity? That really depends. I'll tell you how it depends. If you get a prepaid postage envelope for which the charity has to pay 40 cents per letter, and you save them that money by putting on a stamp, then indeed that is added to your donation. If, on the other hand, they give you an envelope without postage, it is technically not part of your charitable donation, but you might be able to deduct it from your income base. In other words, it might be a deduction against income as an expense, but it is not per se a charitable donation. Does Maser apply separately to my side business if incorporated? Yes, it would. But basically, you aggregate everything, because halakha does not recognize corporations as totally separate entities. So in computing your maaser obligation, you take your profits, your losses of all of your businesses, you net them together, and the maaser is on the net profit. Can I ask a poor person for change? Well, assuming you give him something. Yes. You can take change. You can also take change from a tzedakah box. Sometimes people put in $10, take out 5. As long as you don't put in 5, take out 10. You know, you can take change from a tzedakah box as well. Okay. If patronizing a poor person doesn't count, except to the degree you would have paid more, yes, then it appears that Rambam's highest degree of charity doesn't count. How can that be? That's a good point. The Rambam's highest degree of charity, as I mentioned, was giving somebody the wherewithal to make a living, and certainly patronizing the poor is the highest level of charity. So I wasn't suggesting it is a lower level of charity. I was just suggesting that the amount that counts towards maaser might be limited. In other words, for example, if I wanted to buy something that would cost $10, and I pay the poor person $20 to get it, I only get a $10 credit on my maaser bill, but the spiritual reward of that type of charity might be higher than the $20. In other words, it's really a question of apples and oranges. One is, how much money am I deemed to have given to charity? And the answer is, I've only given the 10 and not the 20. How much reward do I get in the world to come? I might get more for that $10, precisely because I enhanced dignity. The measure of the value of charity is not only a function of the dollar amount for which you're credited. So that would be the complexity there. Well, a lot of questions here. Okay. My husband is often out of town. I am home alone. Okay, this is a very important rule as a matter of safety. A woman in particular who is home alone should never answer the door to any solicitor. She shouldn't even say, my husband is not home. She just should not answer at all. People can come back later. They can leave an envelope if they want. But certainly, safety is paramount. The fact that people are dressed a certain way is unfortunately, it's rare, but it's unfortunately not a guarantee. So that is an important thing to be aware of. Regarding the 10%, it is only for Jewish charity. No, non-Jewish charities can be included. I would even say this, where things get controversial is when you have charities that are sponsored by religious groups, Catholic charities. I would say that as long as the money you're giving is not going towards religious indoctrination or conversion, but it's going towards pure social services. And a lot of Catholic charity work is really pure social service. You need to investigate this exactly. Then even if it goes under the name Catholic charity, that's not a bad thing. I am personally aware of a number of Jewish couples who have adopted children through the auspices of Catholic charities. So it shouldn't scare you. Catholic charities does not necessarily mean you have to avoid it. Where do contributions to health charities fit in? For example, contributions to the American Cancer Society. That's a good question. Now, direct contributions to hospitals are clearly charitable in nature, simply because part of what hospitals do is, at least public hospitals, they provide direct medical services to indigent patients who are not able to afford the bill and don't have insurance. That is a charity. It is a bit more difficult when you're dealing with basic medical research. You have the Alzheimer's Foundation, you have the American Cancer Society, and the like. Here, too, we would consider this to be valuable charities, but they are fairly low on the priority list, and that's really for two reasons. Number one, because they have a donor base that's extremely broad. They basically have the whole United States. So consequently, the need for you to make a major contribution is somewhat less. In other words, simply because, you know, there are more people giving to the American Cancer Institute than to the Hebrew Academy of Greater Washington or the like. And number two, although Jews certainly benefit from this, but these are general charities, these are not Jewish causes, so as a matter of priority, you would prioritize the Jewish local need over the national general need. But certainly, basic medical research does have a role in halachic giving. It is a cause to which some resources should be devoted, but they are not of the highest priority. If one pays for someone to learn Torah with them, can that be deducted from ma'aser? And what about tutoring for children with special needs? Very excellent question. In a sense, it depends on whether the person that you're hiring to learn, be your chavrusa, is somebody who needs this income supplement for a basic standard of living. If they need it, then 100%, it is absolutely a legitimate ma'aser expense. If they're doing fine, but you're paying them some extra money for their services, then it's still a mitzvah, but it's not a maisha deduction itself. Tutoring for children with special needs above tuition costs can be a maser expense. That is correct, because that goes beyond, although every parent would do it, but that goes beyond the halachic obligation, and therefore it can be considered a charitable a need. So that's an important thing to know as well. How do I distinguish or determine the legitimacy of requests for donations? Well, I wish I had the full answer. I mean, in truth, this is the $64,000 question, $64 million question, which I cannot give you a definitive answer. All I can tell you is, as I indicated, there is no rule that you have to respond to all mail solicitations. There is also... if there's no rabbinical approbations, you can throw it out. I would be willing to say that. And at that point, Rav Pam makes this point, that even with all these priority lists, ultimately there's a certain subjectivity in where your heart leads you to feel that there's the most worthy causes. There is a role here for conscience and discretion. There are those, for example, who are gravitated towards hospitals and helping the sick. There are those who gravitate towards the support of Torah. There are those who want to focus, for example, on giving money to the Art Scroll Heritage Foundation to publish Jewish books that will last for hundreds and hundreds of years, as opposed to individual yeshivas. And a person has to find where their heart leads them. There are those that want to go with the self-sufficiency schools that help people get trades and the like. So the issue with charity, and this is unfortunate, is not so much what's legitimate and what's not legitimate. There is indeed a certain percentage that are fraudulent or not legitimate, but that is not really the major question. That is, when all is said and done, that is relatively a small percentage. The real problem is the prioritization of all of those things that are legitimate, and then you have to pick and choose. For example, if you get letters from Israel from funds that collect money for needy brides, and you get 10 letters from 10 different funds, you don't have to give to all of them. You might decide, I want to give X amount of dollars for Achnasas Kala, and I'll divide it among 10 organizations, or I'll give everything to one organization. Those are legitimate decisions that you can make. At Tzedakah Inc., one of the benefits of Tzedakah Inc. is that it gives you the ability to have information about how to evaluate that. But there is unfortunately no magic answer. Again, we receive approximately 40 mailings each week. Is there an appropriate way to limit these, especially if we do not plan to contribute to some of these inquiries? Well, throw a lot of them out. That's basically what you can do. Does giving to a research organization count? Yes, it does, although it is not on the highest level of tzedakah priority. What do you do if a face-to-face meshulach represents an organization that you have theological, philosophical, political differences? How can you ask a face-to-face mashulach about administrative costs without humiliating them? Well, to take the second question first, sometimes the mashulach doesn't even know. And once again, I would say check Ira's website, and perhaps you'll get the information that you need. When you have an organization that you disagree with, it really depends on why you disagree with them. If you disagree with them because you consider it evil, if that would be an extreme, then you shouldn't give to evil causes. You know, if the, I mean, Havdalah, I'm not comparing any Jewish organization to this, but, you know, if the Nazis were, you know, collecting for a reunion ball or something like that, you know, there would be no concept of not embarrassing the person. However, most of the time, the issue is not they're evil, they're corrupt, they're bad. It's just, you know, I don't think it is a very worthwhile organization, or I don't agree with their position about the state of Israel and the like. But even those organizations do good work. I mean, let me give you an example. You have the yeshiva from Mea Sharim that's collecting money. Now, the yeshiva doesn't believe in the state of Israel until Mashiach comes. The yeshiva does not are anti-Zionist. But, you know, it's not that they spend the whole day, you know, giving speeches against anti-Zionism and, you know, you're paying for speeches, you know, against the state of Israel. They have soup kitchens. They have regular Gemara classes. They provide food and shelter. So even when you have ideological differences, there is still a lot of good and valuable work that is being done. And as a result, I think at least a token donation would be appropriate even for those organizations.
Rabbi, I just want to say, we don't want to impose on your hospitality, so you should feel free to answer as many as you feel comfortable.
Once I got the list, I'm going to plow through it. Okay. Okay. But people want to leave, they can leave. I don't want to keep people here if they want. You mentioned saving requests for a month or so. What is the longest you can hold on to charity money? Yeah. It is advisable to clear your accounts within a year. In other words, you can pick any tax year you want. The minhag is Rosh Hashanah to Rosh Hashanah. So you should try to pay your maser obligation based on that. If for accounting reasons the secular year works better for you, either January to December or April, whatever your tax year is, you can work with any alternative year as well. What about synagogue dues? One is not obligated to join. Yeah, that's a good point. If you're not obligated to join a synagogue, you can have in mind, you don't have to tell the shul this, that you are going to use your tzedakah money for synagogue dues. It becomes like aliyos and the like. The same thing is true for building fund obligations and the like. Any obligation that is based on your commitments, you can circumscribe your commitment to say, I'm going to use my charity money. The big question is, though, is a person obligated to join a synagogue? That's really the question. See, a building fund, I may not have to contribute if I don't want to, unless the shul makes it mandatory. But the question becomes, is a Jewish person obligated to belong to a synagogue? Now, many religious people, not so much in Silver Spring, but in some actually very religious communities where the main allegiance is to their yeshiva instead of a shul, there are people who don't belong to synagogues. They daven every day. They daven three times a day. And they go to shul every day. But they don't belong to a synagogue. They say, you know, I daven here sometimes. I daven here sometimes. I don't feel any particular allegiance. That itself is a controversial halachic question. It is clear, according to halacha, that a community is obligated to build a synagogue. We have to have a synagogue. One might assume it is a corollary of that proposition that if I live in a community, I am obligated to contribute to the upkeep of the synagogue. That would appear to be a corollary. Where it's complicated is, a community need have only one synagogue. So it depends. Here, in Potomac, you're blessed that you have so many synagogues within a block or another. So one could not say, I'm obligated to belong to this synagogue, because this isn't the only one. Well, can one say that about every synagogue? I don't have to give here because I could go there. I don't have to give there because I could go here. Right? How does that work? You have to have one synagogue here. Right? You don't have to have three. So, if indeed it is the case that one does not have a halachic obligation to join any particular synagogue if you have a choice of synagogues, then indeed you could use your maser money. If, on the other hand, I don't know if Woodside counts as one. We only have one synagogue, although we're... You know, we're near the National Synagogue, some other places. But the thing is that if indeed you live in a small community where there is only one shul, then it is arguably halachic obligation for you to maintain the upkeep of that shul as a member of a community. As a result, you would not be able to use maser money. So it kind of depends on how we define the obligation. Synagogue dues, okay. to buy food at a Shomer Shabbos store rather than a Giant. Yeah, well, this is an issue that comes up. You know, in Baltimore, just to give you a mini controversy there, you know, there's a very good Chinese restaurant owned by a non-Jew. And a lot of people like to go there. The food is of superior quality compared to other establishments. And the question was raised, well, you know, you have a Shomer Shabbos business, and then you have a business owned by a non-Jew. Isn't there a mitzvah to patronize a Jewish business, and particularly a Shabbos observant business? Isn't that the same as giving charity, as it were, even if you don't like what you're getting, giving charity, as it were, to the Jewish business? Well, once again, these things are tricky. Certainly, if the Shomer Shabbos business is suffering significantly, there would be a special mitzvah to patronize the business. That would be the Rambam's first level of charity, enabling somebody to make a living. However, we couldn't adopt that on a one-to-one basis. You know, if this Sunday afternoon I go to a certain place instead of the Shomer Shabbos place, that alone, as an individual decision, is not hurting the business. So it really depends on how bad the business is suffering. If the business is indeed suffering, if it's anticipated the business will suffer, there would be a mitzvah to forego your tastes in Chinese food or whatever and go to the Shomer Shabbos business. But other than that, there would be no obligation to prefer a service that you don't like as much simply because the person is Shomer Shabbos. How do I prioritize my giving to tzedakah mishulachim who come to my door, my house, or in shul? I don't think there is any particular prioritization there because all three are face-to-face contacts. So I don't think there's any priority. As I say, the obligation is a minimal donation, and then you assess whether it's worthy of more. It really makes no difference if it's at home or in shul. Now, one thing one has to think about is this, and this I think is a little unfortunate. You know, we have mishulachim who often come to our homes, and we don't like to be interrupted. You know, it's not always that that pleasant. And we tell them, leave a note, leave a mail, come back later, whatever it is, or leave me your address. And all of that is legitimate, other than the token donation. But it's especially difficult when your children are around. Because if your children see that you are irritated by people who want tzedakah, and they'll kind of say, oh, the mishulach is here again type of thing, it's very, very bad. And one of the unfortunate side effects of the proliferation of requests that we get is I think, I know myself as well, that I think we give tzedakah much less joyfully than perhaps we did when there was not so many needs. And when your children are around, you got to be very, very careful not to convey a negative attitude towards giving. And if when they come to the home, you're more grouchy, it would actually be better for them not to come to your home so you could be grouchy and show when the kids aren't around than for the children to see it when you're there. My shul has no formal due structure, expects monthly contributions. I donate monthly, but they seem dissatisfied and want 50% more. They say, two-thirds go to the rabbi. Do I need to donate more money? Well, you know, you should take it up with your treasurer. If the official policy is there is no formal due structure, then, you know, you have no obligation, essentially. It is simply a request for more money. And then you balance it versus everything else. Now, I will say this. I'm not saying this out of self-interest. If the rabbi needs more money, that's a fairly high priority on the list. I'm not referring to myself. The reason that's so is that just as the halacha is, you give priority to your relatives over strangers, it is brought down, you give priority to the religious institutions that service your family over the religious institutions that service others. You give to the yeshivos where your children attend more than you would give to other yeshivas. So similarly, when you're divvying up your money among worthy recipients, so to speak, the rabbi that is your rabbi, assuming that, you know, you have a connection with that person, is actually something that is worthy of consideration, provided, you know, he could use the extra money. You know, if he doesn't need it, you know, Of course, that may be a difference of opinion there. You can make that judgment. By the way, let me just digress for a moment, because there was a question I remember getting. I don't know if it's on this list, but somebody asked me before about grandparents' obligations, because it is a fairly controversial issue. There are many parents who cannot meet full tuition in Jewish day schools because they have a lot of kids and whatever, and they're young and starting off. And the question then becomes, schools want to know, do they have a right to go to grandparents who might be a bit more established and say, hey, you got to pay the tuition shortfall. And grandparents say, well, we give our charity elsewhere, etc. Now, here's the interesting point. Interestingly enough, the halacha says that just as parents are obligated in the Jewish education of their children, grandparents are obligated if the parents are not able to pay. So there is such a concept as grandparents bearing the obligation for the Jewish education of their grandchildren. However, grandparents have a little bit of a break. They can use their maser money to meet that obligation, although parents should not. So, which means we would basically tell grandparents the following. It's a legitimate school policy to say, listen, if you separate 10% of your income for charity, then you should use at least some of that money towards tuition shortfalls for the benefit of your grandchildren. That is a legitimate policy. Grandparents should not have to pay anything in excess of what their maser obligations are, but that is a legitimate and even a prioritized obligation of maser money because of the special connection that grandparents should have to the Torah institutions where their children are studying. Can you elaborate regarding priorities of giving other than geographical? Day school, shul, federations. Yeah, that's a very excellent question. According to the halacha, the maintenance of, after you take care of your relatives, your parents, your children, your relatives, the support of Torah institutions is considered to be the highest level of priority in the distribution of maser, even ahead of the general poor. Now, then we have a machlokes. Okay, Torah institutions. How do you prioritize Torah institutions? For example, what's more significant, a day school, which trains, you know, educates young children, or an advanced yeshiva or kollel that educates the older generation and trains them to be rabbis and teachers? There we, interestingly enough, have a machlokes, we have an argument among poskim. Rav Moshe Feinstein took the position. As important as day schools are, he took the position that schools that train advanced scholars and teachers and rabbis, he felt, had priority even over day schools, because by increasing the leadership of a religious community, that will ultimately influence the youth as well. Others talk about the primacy of day schools. I cannot say there's a definitive decision on that. I would say that by and large, Jewish education is a higher priority than a synagogue. A synagogue is very important, obviously. But, and of course, a synagogue to a large degree is also an institution of Jewish education and teaching. And Beth Shalom, our talk tonight, and all of the wonderful educational work that Beth Shalom does and other congregations do. Nevertheless, if it's a question of a building versus the operating budget of a Jewish educational institution, we would say the educational activities do have a higher priority. Interestingly enough, the highest priority in a community is building a mikveh, as you may know, because a mikveh permits husband and wife to have marital intimacy, which ultimately brings everything else into being. But the support of Torah is the most important. Then we would talk about a shul. A federation can be very, very significant. Because the truth of the matter is, a donation to a federation includes everything. There's Jewish education components. There is social welfare. There is charity to the poor. There are social services. So I would think that a federation would rank fairly high, but I think it would be subordinate to direct giving to Jewish educational institutions. Is kirov a form of charity? This question might mean two things, and actually both are interesting points. Certainly, money that you donate to Jewish outreach organizations is absolutely charity, because that money is used to fund educational programs that bring people to Yiddishkeit. But there's another aspect of this question. Rav Moshe Feinstein issued a very interesting psak years ago. It's not so relevant to this talk, but he says, just like a person must give 10% of their income to charity and service of God, a person should give 10% of their time for outreach to other Jews. He called this maaser of zaman, and not just maaser of money. Meaning a person should look at their weekly schedule, at least their free time, however that's defined, and they should devote a certain percentage of that time, 10% optimally, towards reaching out to others and bringing them towards Klal Yisrael and towards Yiddishkeit. There's a very magnificent program that actually makes it very easy to do. This is called Partners in Torah, which is a national program, and it sets up telephonic chavrusas. You can get a study partner over the phone. Well, you know, somebody could be in Los Angeles, and you could be here. And, you know, you indicate on the application forms, what would you like to study, what's your background, etc. And you can get a chavrusa in Chumash, in Tefillah, in Ivrit, you know, in anything you want. And that's kind of a way in which both people learn and teach from each other, and they give their time to Klal Yisrael. So that's also a form of charity. Is disability retirement considered income, and does the 10% apply? Yes, it is considered income, and the 10% applies, but let me point out this. I'm not sure if I made this point clear. If a person is functioning at a very low income level, so they need 100 cents of their dollar to break even on basic living expenses, they can declare themselves poor, and they can use their maaser money for themselves. Because if I can give money to a poor person who's as bad off as I am, why can't I use it for myself? Now, it's important that this not be abused, because we're not saying, you know, every luxury I want, I could therefore use my maaser money for. But if I really cannot make ends meet, I can use my own maaser money, but it is strongly recommended, in very strong terms, that you do this with no more than 50%. In other words, you should not use 100% of your charity money on you. But if you're really poor, you're really in a difficult situation, you can use up to 50% of it. What is the source that synagogues are tzedakah? It's a good question. Technically, synagogues are not tzedakah. I should have perhaps been a little more analytically clear. Rather, the obligation of ma'aser, when you give 10%, according to many Rishonim, is not limited to the tzedakah that you give to the poor, but it applies to supporting all institutions that are necessary for the maintenance of a Jewish community. So in a sense, you are correct. A Beis HaKnesses is not tzedakah, but it is treated as a legitimate maser expense because it is what is called the tzorche mitzvah, which maser money is appropriate for. What is the latest time you should open your door? Well, I'll leave it up to you. I think that 10 o'clock or so is a reasonable response. But you know, it really depends. You know, when you're kind of closed for the night, you certainly do not have to get out of bed to answer the door, unless you have a sense it's an emergency. And God forbid, if there are emergencies, you get up at 2 o'clock in the morning. But if people are just collecting around. Now, what you might want to do is, and this might be a way to also make things a little easier, you can leave a sign outside of your door that basically says, we do not accept solicitors after 10 o'clock, but if you leave an envelope with an address and information about the cause, we will try to respond. And that way they're supposed to leave you an envelope. That is not considered slamming the door in their face, because they're told ahead of time that that is the rule of the home. Okay. One half of the tuition to Jewish schools goes to non-Torah subjects. Can that one half be considered tzedakah? Yeah, that's a very interesting question. I had mentioned before that the reason day school tuition is not a maser deduction is because since you have to pay for it because the obligation of a parent to teach a son Torah, therefore, it cannot be charity because it's an obligation. So the question that was raised is, well, my halachic obligation is to pay for the Jewish education of my child. To pay for the secular education of my child is not a halachic obligation. So if it's not a halachic obligation, can I use my maser money for it? Well, interestingly enough, you could stand this on its head and say, well, if there's no halachic obligation to pay for secular education, is that even a charitable need at all? In other words, you can make the opposite argument and say, it's not stuck at all. The Jewish education might be charity, but since I got to do it halachically, it doesn't count. The secular is optional anyway. So a similar question was raised by Rav Moshe about tuition for girls. Because under strict halacha, there is no obligation to give girls a formal Jewish education. So somebody argued, therefore, should it be charity? Rav Moshe argued, in this day and age, because of the secular influence of society, a parent is absolutely obligated to give their daughter a religious Jewish education. Therefore, it's not deductible. But coming back to this question, it would appear that we do not allow the deduction of the secular tuition either. Then I have my final two questions. You said that synagogue donation to a building fund do count as charity, because it is not required. What about annual dues and holiday tickets? Well, once again, I would say the following idea. Annual dues are not required simply because you can decide not to be a member. In other words, every year, you make a decision that I want to be a member. If I want to be a member, I got to pay my dues. In that sense, when I decide to renew my membership, I'm entitled to have in mind, I don't have to tell the show, that I am considering this a charitable contribution. So the same thing with holiday tickets, meaning unless you signed a 5-year membership pledge or something, if your membership is an annual membership, you can make that decision every year. And the last question, can you rank or discuss the following museums: Kennedy Center, University's Jewish Summer Camp, Secular Summer Camp for Poor Disabled, Unknown Jewish Kollels versus some, McKenna's Wagon. Is that a homeless? I don't know what McKenna's Wagon is. I have not heard of that. Okay. Well, in terms of ranking, I would say Kollel is number one. Jewish Summer Camp for others is number two. Secular Summer Camp for Poor and Disabled is number three. Universities, museums, if you're contributing to a scholarship fund, if it's a scholarship fund for people who can't afford it, that would be number four. A museum would be number five. Kennedy Center, I'm not sure if it's even on the list. I'm not sure what is the work, because it makes programs available for people who can't afford it, like they can go to a concert or something like that. That would be, I think, although that's nice, but I think that would be the bottom of the list here. So again, I apologize for the fact that there are so many questions that remain unanswered. All I can say is that Pirkei Avos tells us, Lefum Tzara Agra, according to the suffering, is the reward. And tzedakah not only requires us to put in the effort of writing the check and giving up money, which is a form of tzar, but it also requires very, very difficult thoughts. And you really have to evaluate, look at things carefully. I'll repeat my suggestion that you save things for a month or so, get a sense of the terrain of the land, and then you're able perhaps to make more sophisticated and valid judgments. And again, all of us owe a great debt of gratitude to Ira for tzedakah, Inc., which allows us to have the information necessary to make those decisions. Thanks a lot. Okay.
Rabbi, an appreciation for your wonderful remarks, insights, and scholarship. We want to present you with a tzedakah box.
Thank you so much. I will try to use it, David.
We know you will use it. We know you'll fill up many, many times.
Thank you. Thanks so much. Thanks, Ira. Thank you.